Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 30 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Robert Bubby Lewis, better known as Bubby, and I'm a bass player, producer, composer, whatever you want to call it, and that's about it.
And what are you calling yourself these days, like right now? Solo artist? Is that?
I guess, yeah, a recording artist, solo artist, whatever you want to call it. I'm just kind of venturing out, seeing whatever I can do, whatever's fun, you know, whatever I like, I guess.
You have one of those careers that I personally find super fascinating, and part of it is because of sort of how things clicked for you. And I think a lot of people sort of feel it's going to be steps. You know, I'm going to play the bars, or I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to meet that artist who'll introduce me to that artist. But you had a strange thing where, I mean, you'll tell the story better than I will, but you moved to L.A. A buddy of yours who happens to be a very well-known bass player as well makes a call, and suddenly you're like on tour with Snoop Dogg.
Yep, Andrew Gouche, man, the godfather. Yep.
So, I mean, that it is one of those things where every musician probably waits for a moment like that. When you reflect back on it, is it crazy that it happened for you so fast? Do you think it was a good thing that it happened so fast? Like, how do you look back on that time?
It's kind of weird looking at it now when I look back, because back then it seemed like forever. You know, like I moved to L.A. in 2005 during the summer, and it wasn't until, man, it wasn't until like the very end of 2006 when I got the phone call to even do that. And then 2007 rolled around, and it wasn't until, I don't know, May, I believe it was May, when I actually did like my first rehearsal with them, you know. So it seemed like forever, but when I look back at it now, it was like, oh, it was only like a year and a half, you know. Yeah. But I think about it all the time, man. It's one of those situations where I'm still just so grateful, and like I'll never forget the entire experience, like, you know, this little kid from Flint, you know, and Gouche believed in me that much where he just made a phone call and that was it, you know.
Okay, so there's a couple things I'm so curious about. One is Flint, Michigan to L.A. Was your going there clearly the bass thing, or did you have, I mean, were you going there to be a bassist?
Well, a funny story, and I'll try not to make it long, but basically everybody that knows of me, or they know, you know, like anybody that has maybe heard of me or know anything about me or talks to me or whatever, I'm a huge nerd. So video games,
we're going to get into that, because you and I could do a total podcast just on that's my life too, but we'll talk. But you keep going.
Well, we definitely got to talk about that. Video games, Japanese anime, sci-fi, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, you know, all of that kind of stuff, Harry Potter, you name it. So I basically was moving to L.A. to go to school for video game art design. I used to draw, believe it or not. I was an artist growing up. I was, you know, really drawing a lot of Japanese anime style stuff, or like, you know, I'm a big, huge Marvel and DC comics fan, even Dark Horse, you know, so I wanted to do that. And I signed up with a school, and, you know, I did all the testing and stuff and all the, you know, all the things needed to get enroll into the school, and even paid like the initiation fees and all that kind of stuff. And so me and my buddy Melvin Payne, we both were going for the same thing. We went to high school and junior high together. So I was like, man, let's go out to L.A. and go to this school. So he's like, yeah, you know, we both wanted to draw. And it's so funny, man. The day, like, while I was driving, I was talking to this representative. I had been speaking with her the entire time for the past few months. And she told me, make sure you come on Wednesday to the school and meet everybody, and we'll let you know about your classes, this, this, that, and the other. So Wednesday rolls around, and I show up, and I kid you not, the people there were like, we don't know who you are. We don't have anything, your name on file or anything like that. And I was like, what do you mean? I've been talking to, I think her name was Cindy or something like that. And I was like, I've been talking to Cindy. And she was like, there is no Cindy here. And I was like, no, you got to be kidding me. Like, I got the address, I got the book and all this kind of stuff. And she was like, we don't have you on file. So if you want to attend here, you have to do everything over and you'll have to wait till the next semester. And I was just like, wow. So I was stuck in L.A.
But wait, hold on. What was that story? Mm-hmm. What is that? Who is this person on the phone? You never found out?
Yeah, no. I mean, I she was a representative, and even the book she sent me of the school that I was trying to attend, I mean, it had her card on it and the whole nine. Like, my parents had spoke with her and everything. And my buddy Melvin, his parents spoke with her, and she was going to be like my representative that I deal with while I was going to this school. And it was like they had no idea who she even was. And when I kept telling them, check my, you know, my records, my social security number, everything, it was like, we don't have anything on you on file. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me.
So was she like a scam artist? This, but like, what's the gig there? That's a crazy story.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. So here I am, what was I, 18 or 19 or something like that. And I was just like, wow, I just drove across the country. And I told my parents, you know, me and Melvin had got like a studio apartment, a tiny studio apartment in Sherman Oaks, California, you know, and I mean, we were here. So that was it, man. And I brought my basses with me, of course. And I just was like, well, I'm here. So let me just see if I can survive. I have my oldest sister and then my other older sister living out here already. So, you know, and they were like around the corner. One of them lived in the same apartment complex. The other one was down the street. So I just stuck out here, man. And it definitely wasn't for me to pursue music like that. Like, my cousins are all in the music industry. You know, they've worked with Puffy and 50 Cent and Nelly and Aaliyah and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they was like, well, you can come work with us. You can come work with us. But my thing was, I wanted something to fall back on. That's the way I was thinking back then, you know. So, but as you can see, that didn't that didn't really happen.
So. Okay, so the next part that I'm super curious about is and Andrew Gucci. So how do you meet him? How does one befriend him to make that type of call to Snoop? I mean, that's also so, it's like I read these articles about you, and I'm like, there's so much missing from this story that I'm dying to know.
Man. It's so much stuff. So how I met Andrew Gucci was at my very first NAMM show. I believe it was 2003, because I started playing bass in 2001. Yeah, I had only been playing bass basically for like a year and a half. And my sister got me a badge, a visitor's badge to NAMM show, came out here with her to the 2003 NAMM. And, you know, I'm just like a kid in a candy store, basses that I've never seen before, instruments, all kind of stuff I've never seen before, especially living in Flint. Like, we had one music store back then, you know, and it definitely wasn't a Guitar Center nor a Sam Ash. Like, you had to go to Detroit to even, like, put it
see
like
a
this.
Bass.
Like,
yeah, like bass in the music stores, yeah.
Dude, I kid you not, man. Like, I had never even heard of a boutique bass. Like, I didn't know anything about any, like, you know, MTD basses and all that kind of Federas. I didn't know anything about those. I just, it was like, what is that? You know, and I didn't know nothing about that. You know, it's like all I was used to was Ford, and I had never seen a Bugatti before, basically. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, Gucci, I was jamming out at some booth, and I, you know, I had my eyes closed, and I was just happy just to be playing music. And when I opened up my eyes, it was like thousands of people just standing around. So I'm a teenager at that point. I think I was 16 or something like that at that point, 16 or 17. And I got terrified because, you know, it just kind of creeped me out. Like, what are all these people looking at? And I just seen this big, huge black dude, like, looking at me through this window. And he was just shaking his head. And I was like, dang, is this guy security? So he grabs me and he's like, you come with me. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm about to get put out. I don't know what to do. Like, this huge building, I don't know where my sister is. So I had a Nextel phone back then, the ones where you chirp. So I'm trying to, like, secretly chirp my sister, like, help. You know what I'm saying? Like, help me. This dude is about to put me out. I didn't do nothing. And he takes me to Mike Tobias's booth, and he tells me, sit down. And I'm like, well, I got to find my sister. And he said, look, man, just be quiet and just play. Just play. Don't worry about nothing. Just play. I played, and Mike gave me his card after that and was like, if you're ever interested in the bass, you let me know. And then finally, the big black dude was like, man, you're killing. And I was like, oh, well, thanks. And he said, I'm Andrew Goucher. And when he said that, I was like, what? You know, like,
you knew his music. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But again, Flint, Michigan. And then, too, it back then it was AOL dial-up, so I didn't know what Andrew Goucher looked like. All I knew is the name from listening to millions of albums, you know, the Hawkins Family, James Cleveland, James Moore, the Winans. I just knew of his name. And when he told me that, I was like flabbergasted, you know. And ever since then, we just kept in touch. He told me, if you ever move to L.A., you hit me up. And sure enough, when I came to L.A., he said, come by the house, come to this jam and all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, that year and a half, it went by, and he called me on a Sunday afternoon. I went to visit my cousin's church, and he said, hey, man, how's everything been going? I said, oh, I'm good, man, just chilling. He said, who you playing with now? And I said, nobody. And he kind of got mad. He was like, you mean to tell me you've been out here for this long and you ain't got on nobody's gig yet? And I was like, nah. And he was like, why? And I said, nobody has called me. And he was like, what do you mean? And I was just like, nobody has asked me to do anything. And he just was like flustered. He was like, this is ridiculous. He said, you should have been on somebody's gig a long time ago. And I was like, I don't know, man. So he says, let me call you back. 45 minutes later, he calls me back and he said, I got you on Snoop's gig. They're going to be calling you.
And were you like, come on, you're kidding? Or were you like, oh,
cool. Yeah. I was like, what? I was like, what do you mean? He said, listen, I already told you. I called somebody and they're going to put you on Snoop's gig. They're going to call you. And I was like, well, do I have to audition? He said, listen, they're going to call you. Just that's it. And I mean, it seemed like a few weeks went by and Marlon Williams called me, the guitar player, and that was it. You know, he met up with me, gave me some DVDs of performances that they've done and was like, just listen to this. He said, learn all of these songs. He said, even if it's not on here, just learn as many songs as you can. And that's what I did. And then finally, I had so many jobs, man. I worked at like shipping companies. I worked for MySpace at one point. I worked for like Costco. I was doing all stuff just trying to like, oh my bad, just trying to survive, you know, because it was rough.
Yeah. And so,
then, you know,
tell me a little bit about that first gig, not sort of the first gig you played with Snoop, but rather being immersed in that environment. You're not someone then who's sort of had that experience of touring, of playing that often, that frequently, with the travel, with that life. So how did you adjust to in terms of like being a musician and an artist? Because you're really thrown. I mean, that is the, you know, you're literally thrown into the lion's pit.
Yeah, like it was. You know how sometimes and with certain things in life, you kind of move up the ladder. For me, I felt like I was just immediately placed on top of this building, you know, instead of climbing up steps and you know, I just went from 0 to 10 just like that. And honestly, it's no way you really can prepare for it. You just learn as you go, you know. You know, like I didn't know what it meant to be on a plane every day and on a tour bus and you're getting like 2 hours of sleep and then you go do a TV show this day, but tomorrow you got to play in front of 250,000 people and then the next day you got to play in front of 5,000. Then the next day you're in the studio, and then the next, you know, I didn't know nothing about that. It's just, you just kind of just go with it, you know?
But it must have taught you something, I mean, a lot about not only yourself, but like what it means to be a musician and an artist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. And the one thing, you know, Goucher told me, Goucher just said, just handle your business. Just do business. Like, and you know, me, I'm, you know, I don't criticize anybody for what they do, but I'm a square, man. Like, I've never, still to this day, I've never drank anything or did any type of drugs. I'm literally like a nerd square, you know? I'm
a nerdy church boy. You're what we call on the metal side, you're straight edge.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, dude. And that's what it is. So all I wanted to do, I just wanted to play music, man. I just wanted to play music. And still to this day, like, even I just came off the road with Snoop and I do the same thing now that I was doing 10 years ago. We do the show, go back to the room, I watch cartoons, I call my wife, and that's it, you know?
It's an amazing thing to hear, too, just considering the brand of Snoop. I mean, just the sort of the pot in and of itself. Like, I mean, you can say, like, I don't do anything. I'm sure there's tons of contact high just from being around that stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And the thing about it, people ask me, like, do you mean to tell me you don't get high? To my knowledge, I don't even know what that feels like. Compared to what people say it is, I haven't felt it yet. Yeah, of course, I've been in a room where it's a mountain of weed on the table and stuff, you know, but that's their thing. That's what they do. And it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, but it's funny.
Does that culturally put you on, not on the outs, but sort of like, you know, I mean, it's part of the thing when you're on the road and with guys like that and people like that. That's interesting.
Nah, because the thing about it is, on the outside, it seems like, put it like this, sometimes some musicians that don't do that type of stuff, they feel like they have to start in order to fit in. But the truth is this, if you have an identity, keep that identity, and people will respect you more, actually. You know, like Snoop, I'll never forget, we were in Denmark, and the first tour I did with him, it's like I did 3 shows in Southern California, and then immediately, a few days later, we were going to Europe. I had never been out of the country before or anything like that. I had to expedite my passport.
I was going
to
say, yeah.
Yeah. And we're sitting in the room around in a circle. This was like tradition. Always do the show, and then after the show, go back to Snoop's room. We watch the game or either play Madden or NBA 2K. And there was this huge mountain of weed on the table, and we're all sitting in a circle, and I'm just sitting there chilling, you know. And I'm sitting next to Snoop, and he tries to pass me the blunt when it comes around to me. And I was like, oh, no, man, I'm cool. And he just calmly said, oh, you don't smoke, nephew? And I said, no, I don't smoke. And he looked at me. He said, that's good. Keep it like that.
Oh, I thought he was going to say more for me is what I thought he would have
said. Well, he said he definitely did finish with more for me. And that was like the finishing joke. He said, that's good, nephew. Keep it like that. More for me anyway, you know. And then he laughed or whatever. But you know, it's like a mutual respect. Like, you know, I sit up and I watch Dragon Ball Z all day long. Not everybody likes Dragon Ball Z. I'm not gonna criticize them if they don't watch Dragon Ball Z. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's all about you just having your own thing. You know what I'm saying?
So, how long has this relationship been with Snoop?
I've known him now for like 10 years.
And it's still consistent. You're still playing. What's it like for you professionally? Are you on the road with him? Do you record albums still? Is it full on?
Well, yeah. I mean, the way it kind of happened was I played with him for about 5 years. And then I started playing full time with Lupe Fiasco for a couple years. And then I went from Lupe Fiasco to Jhené Aiko. And I saw Snoop last year. I was out in Japan touring with an artist out there, AI, for 6 months, but we had to come back for 1 month because, you know, the visa is only 3 months.
Right.
So for that month break, I went out on tour with Jhené Aiko, and she just so happened to be touring with Wiz Khalifa and Snoop. And so it was like a big family reunion. I got a chance to see everybody, and we all just kind of reconnected, and this is that and other. And then out of the blue, Superfly hits me up and says, you know, can you do this run with us, this Snoop tour? And I was like, oh yeah, big, you know, just like old times or whatever. And it just, that's just kind of how this situation happened. And that's why, you know, like he always said, anybody that's ever worked with him, even if he doesn't call you for a while, expect for him to call you at some point. Right. You know, that's just the way it is with a lot of artists, you know, like I think it's so awesome how Nathan East, you'll see him on the road with Toto, but then you'll also see him with Michael McDonald and Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
Foreplay. You know what I'm saying? Like,
totally.
That's cool.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Totally. Yeah, it's funny.
The same.
Yeah, when I was sort of, you know, I don't know how old you are. I'm mid 40s.
I'm 31.
Okay, so a bit of a different generation, but still, like, I remember when I was really into music and just started playing, it was exactly that Nathan East thing where I was like, well, who is this guy in Eric Clapton? He's over here. And I couldn't understand it because at that age, it was like you're either in a band or you were solo. I didn't know that there was like that sort of lifestyle, you know?
Yep.
You sort of really respect it when you see a guy be able to do that year on year. And it's funny, even with Snoop too, because if you think about the genre of rap, hip hop, urban, I mean, he's really had a trajectory that just keeps on going. It's such a rarity, too. So, like, that provides you an opportunity, I'm sure, musically to grow and change and see all the trends. It's so crazy, too.
I've definitely seen a lot with Snoop. I mean, you know, Snoop is one of those people, he's a household name. You know, like, no matter what age you are, no matter what era you were born in, even for the kids of this generation, like, they've heard the name Snoop Dogg because it's just such a... It's just such a household name, you know what I'm saying? And I've never seen some of the stuff, you know. There's stuff I've seen working with him that I could have never imagined even existed. Going to countries like, you know, Lithuania and Bratislava, and you know, just crazy places, Greenland and Iceland and stuff like that, and places I never even thought people toured. Not Nova Scotia, but Kosovo, you know, like Lebanon. And it's like this guy, it's like he's at home everywhere he goes, you know?
Yeah.
But he's just the most humble, down-to-earth person. It's really crazy.
I've seen pieces and articles and interviews with you where people say to you, like, you know, who inspires you, and you sort of rattle off a lot of names, and you go into two areas. Like, you'll tend to go into the sort of bucket that I know, you know, the sort of Jacko and Stanley and Victor, but then you go for sure into the sort of church side / gospel side, which again is just an area. I was a metal kid and alternative guy growing punk, so I didn't have that side exposure to me. But who was the one? Like, was there one at a certain age where you were just like, oh, that? Now, I think based off of what I read, it's this sort of Dave Weckl story. I don't know if that's it.
Yep.
Is that it?
Well, Dave Weckl, because I
wanted
to
play drums. Right, yeah, go on. Yep.
And my sister is a drummer. She told me get Dave Weckl albums, so...
Because that's the easy way to start, right? Like Dave Weckl, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, Dave Weckl. Yeah, she's telling me, like, listen to Dave Weckl, Vinny... And listen to Dennis Chambers and Buddy Rich. And I'm
just
like,
just for the basics.
You know, listen to Virgil Donati and Chad Wackerman. I'm like, and Brooks Wackerman and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the whole Wackerman family. And I'm like, man. So you know, yeah, I went and got the Synergy record. And I heard Tom Kennedy solo on the Synergy song. And I lost it. And at that point, I kind of was like, well, who else does Dave Weckl work with? Came across Chicory Electric Band,
John Patitucci.
My life changed when I heard John Patitucci. That's when, I mean, I already knew I wanted to play bass based off of Tom Kennedy, but it was John Patitucci that really showed me, like, wow, this is what you can do on this instrument, you know? And yeah, of course, I went to Jocko and Stanley Clark, and, you know, all the way back to Charles Mingus, everybody, Jimmy Garrison, Matt Garrison, everybody. I end up checking out everybody, but for me, it was John Patitucci. And then from there, the like, you know, of course I had the Andrew Gouchers and the Fred Hammonds, the Joe Smiths, like the Larry Kimball, all of those guys, Melvin Lee Davis, Nathan East, all of them. But for me, the people that, like, blew my mind so much, aside from all those people I named, it was John Patitucci, Frank Gambale and Alan Holdsworth.
It's crazy too, because I had a sort of similar adoption into that form of music, which nobody around me liked, and I went deep down the rabbit hole. And when I think back on it, I'm like, you have to be young to be able to hear somebody like a John Patitucci and think to yourself, I want to do that. Because I think as you get older, you would hear John Patitucci and go, maybe I'll try kazoo.
You know, like you get lazy or something.
You just like, I could never master it. Like, why even bother? Yeah. Look at this guy. You know?
Yeah, for listening to when I really heard, like, after I was studying Patitucci and then I went on to Frank Gambale and Alan Holdsworth, that's when I was like, they inspired me and encouraged me to say, okay, most people listen to this and say it's impossible, but I want to figure it out. And like, once I was able to understand their music, it like, I don't know, man, it kind of broke every other chain for me. So I was able to pick up on a lot of stuff. And of course I studied a lot of, man, I studied so much of every genre, from metal to punk rock. I mean, Rob Trujillo, Suicidal Tendencies, Infectious Grooves.
Yeah, freaking, those were big ones for me, yeah.
You know, Shinedown. I went to, of course, Mastodon. Like, dude, it was so much stuff that I was listening to. Even Alice Cooper and Judas Priest and Ozzy, like Frank Zappa. I went all over the place. I was literally Magma. I freaking love Magma.
And that's, know? Yeah, but that's how you find who you are, right?
Yeah, you have to kind of expose yourself to everything. I was a huge Rush fan. Shout out to Geddy Lee.
Yeah, he's on my Mount Rushmore of people I need on this show. He's the Mount Rushmore.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Geddy is like, that's like one of the kings, man. Yeah. And I mean, but all of that is what's beneficial when it comes to you figuring out who you are and your sound. You got to be a sponge kind of and just absorb everything. And then you find out what your identity is, you know?
So we established the Weckl Patitucci thing. Now we're going to go into more of the nerd thing. So talk to me a bit about the first sort of, was it comic books? Was it manga? Like for me, it was 100. My dad owned a pharmacy right on the corner, was a newsstand. It was 100% comics.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Two doors down from this newsstand, they opened up the first comic book store. I live in Montreal. And I basically lived there. I mean, to this day, I still have my collection. I still try and hit the Comic Cons when I can. But what was your introduction to it? Was it video games, comic books? What was it for you?
I have to give the credit to my mom in this situation. I don't know what it was with her, but she was like a superhero fanatic. Her favorite hero is the Hulk, and that's just so happens to be mine. It definitely probably was comic books. And let me see, I was 4 years old when I knew the difference. I understood, I'll say that. I learned the difference and started to understand the difference between our American cartoons and then Japanese cartoons. That's okay. When I realized
you were
the
young.
Difference. You know, I was watching Speed Racer. It used to come on TV, but then I was like, man, why is this so weird and so different? And you know what I'm saying?
Totally, totally, totally.
And then I'll never forget, they showed Fist of the North Star on Sci-Fi Network at like midnight. Definitely was supposed to have been sleep, but I stayed up and watched that mug, and it blew me away. So I've been watching anime since then. I've always been into like video games and just Asian culture, period. So yeah, man, for me, it was a number of things. My brother got me into martial arts films, so I've got a collection of Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, Jet Li, Chow Yun-Fat, Tony Jaa, Donnie Yen. Like, I'm just a nerd, man.
No, you're Star Wars. Those are all the same. So like again, because I'm a bit older, my exposure was different. Like we didn't have sci-fi when I was growing up. But two things for me: one was somebody passed me a copy, I don't remember if it might have been Betamax or VHS, of Ninja Scroll.
Oh.
So Ninja Scroll.
Oh my gosh, classic.
Broke me. And again, it's sort of, yeah. I also feel like in retrospect that it was bad, because it was almost like there was nothing even better at the time than that. It was so crazy.
Oh yeah, that's like one of the pioneers of anime film for sure.
And then there was this thing in Montreal called Fantasia, where this guy launched this sort of like local anime Japan martial arts film festival. And wow. I would literally like pack a knapsack. I was a young kid, and I would just like literally just sit in the theater all day and watch all these that you could never see anywhere. I mean, they didn't have them on TV. So so all those things you're saying, you're sort of like laughing, like, oh, I can't believe it. Like, I am all in with you, my friend. I get
man,
it.
Man, dude, I love hearing when people are like into the same stuff as me, man. Like, you know, it's and that's another thing. A lot of the people that I've worked with, it's cool when you find out they're into the stuff too. Like, man, when I found out Snoop was into Star Wars and he's into, you know, I used to get martial arts movies for this guy. You know, like Lupe Fiasco knows, he physically knows every form of martial arts. He can actually do it. Janae Aiko, she's part Japanese and like she likes certain anime and stuff. Like I love when I experience working with people like that, man.
Yeah, no, I'm the guy cool. Where like I travel a lot for speaking, and if I can hit a Chinatown or any like comic book store, manga, even like art, like yes. I love nothing more than a big museum having a show for somebody who's like in some way a comic book artist or manga artist. I go crazy for that stuff. Yeah, it's so fun.
Me and you both, man.
But it's also amazing too, because you know, again, as I get older, I can also sort of reflect on it. You think they're very dispersed and divergent themes, but there really is this sort of art and culture thing that ties all together. Like, it's pretty amazing. Like, even when I go to NAMM and I start talking to peers and friends, it's like everybody does sort of have that same, like, you know, it's almost like subculture, weird niche culture thing.
Yeah,
and bass is totally that too.
Yeah, man, it definitely is. And it's funny you say that, because one of my good friends, I actually talked to him yesterday. I know you know him, Thundercat.
Sure, yeah.
Me and him are like, we're like the same, but we're different. Like when it comes to anime and our love for like culture and stuff like that, and we love music, and I mean, it's like, me and him were just talking yesterday. He was actually giving me all kind of good advice. But as long as I've known him, every time we see each other, we're most likely not even talking about music. We're talking about anime and Japan. You know what I'm saying? Like
random artists about only manga, two people know about. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like I was wearing a Marvel shirt yesterday that had a bunch of different characters on it. And he FaceTimed me. And as soon as he saw the shirt, he was, and you know, and like he'll wear like some kung fu shoes. And I'll be like, those are dope. You know, like we're such nerds, man. But it's cool. It's so cool.
I wanted, once we're on this subject, I mean, you know, when I listen to 1UP, I mean, it's screaming that stuff. It's screaming video games. Even the way the sampling is like done from a tech perspective, and you're almost like overdubs and stuff.
Yep.
What was that? I mean, I sort of listened to that album, and I'll shake my head and go, like, not only like, what was Bubby thinking, but like, how did he, like, did, like, there's certain moments on that album where I'm like, did you mean to? Was everything intentional? The stuff just happened? Because it's so crazy, a lot of it.
Man, everything was just me and the people that were involved just sitting around. We're weird. Well, Frank and Bali told me to stop saying that I'm weird. He told me to say eccentric. So we just sit around and we put all our eccentric thoughts and record it. That's literally what it was. And I mean, stuff just kind of fell together, you know, even all the way down to how the album was mixed. Like I didn't want everything to be super perfect, because if you really listen to it, the entire album is a story. So each song kind of goes into each other almost, but I'm technically on a spaceship. So my spaceship is like not in the best shape. So all the music that's being produced from the spaceship, some songs it might be mixed pretty cool, and then other songs it'll be mixed really dark and rough because my signal is bad from Earth. You know what I'm saying? Like I was trying to just kind of capture that entire emotion, just being nerdy, you know?
Right.
It's really weird.
What are we talking about in terms of time for an album like this? Like, well, how long did it take? Because it just, again, like I look at it, I'm like, it's like I almost like take a deep breath after I'm done listening to him. Like that was it's an effort.
Man, the album took over 2 years, really. And to be totally honest, there's at least maybe like 10 or 12 tracks that didn't make it on the album. The album has 25 tracks. But if I really would have went all the way, there's at least another 12 to 15 tracks that could have went on the album.
When you do an album like that, are you thinking this has to be an expression of how I see music? Are you thinking mm-hmm. this has to be an expression of this instrument that I'm known for, the bass? Do you not look at it from either perspective? How do you sort of approach it as a sort of thought in general?
I mean, the way I look at it, I'm just like, I just want to put something out there that is just a reflection of who I am and everything I'm about, you know? And so, yeah, most of the album is anime, video game sound and stuff. Not everybody knows this, but I love to produce music and stuff and work with artists and stuff. But some of my favorite music to create is video game stuff, Japanese anime or film score stuff. That's where I feel the most freedom, you know? And I just wanted to be able to express that and let people know, like, this is what I hear. This throughout my daily life, when I'm walking down the street or at the gym or eating a burger or whatever, this is what I'm thinking about, you know?
It'd make me crazy to have the Mario theme running in my head all day, so I don't know how you...
Man, I don't know what it is. Like, it's just something about that stuff that inspires me so much, you know?
And you actually wound up, you've done work with Marvel and things like that.
Yeah, fortunate. I've been extremely fortunate to work with Marvel and Funimation and a couple other companies and stuff. That was like some of the highlights of my career, actually, because I'm, you know, I grew up reading comic books and, you know, for Marvel to reach out to me and say, you know, we want you to do some music for some things that we got. I was crying, basically. I literally was just sitting in my house crying, you know.
And is that, what type of work is that? Is that production? Is it composition?
Yeah. So they had me, the first thing they had me do, they were doing this pilot for the, what was it called? I know you've heard of the Heroes for Hire.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and Squirrel Girl. So there's like a separate group of the Heroes for Hire. They're called like the Useless Squad or something like that. I can't even remember the name right now. But basically Marvel was doing a pilot for a potential, you know, TV series. And all they did was just a couple episodes. But when they asked me to do the theme song for it, I was like, wow, are you serious? And I'm a huge Luke Cage fan. And when they reached out to me, they was like, you know, there's a couple of heroes. I don't know if you ever heard of them. And they said, Squirrel Girl. I said, oh, of course. She's dope. She beat Thanos. Like, I knew exactly who she was.
But I'm trying to frame this. How so, like, Iron Fist, Luke Cage, like, for me, that was really in my prime. But again, we have, like, 15-year gap between us. How did you cut? You came to it later, I guess?
Well, what I did was, when I started researching the Hulk, and I was like, was like, who has he fought before? And then, you know, any kid that's into comic books, you want to find out who's the strongest. You know what I'm saying?
So, totally.
Yeah. So then I started getting into all the cosmic beings like Eternity and Infinity and the Living Tribunal, the One Above All and the Anti-Monitor and Doomsday. And, you know, like, so I'm like, who's the most powerful? So then I just came across all these other villains, even like, you know, now the world knows who Groot and Rocket Raccoon is. But I was like, man, I knew exactly who the Guardians of the Galaxy were. Adam Warlock, everybody, you know.
And listen, that band was really obscure.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that it broke through. I mean, I do marvel, pardon the pun with Marvel, but I do marvel at the fact that, like, wow, these really obscure things mm-hmm. from my childhood, like, I could never have imagined are now, like, these massive, I mean, whether it's even, like, for me, even Daredevil was huge.
Oh, absolutely.
I couldn't believe that, like, that was something the world, like, now is cool.
Oh, yeah. I'm so overjoyed about it too. Even like Iron Fist and Luke Cage, like, you know, nobody really knew.
No, yeah. I mean, in the late 70s, they had a lot of cachet with it, but you had to be a real Marvel nerd then.
Right. You know, and even the stuff that DC is doing, like the, you know, man, like Shazam and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm so happy to see. I'm just happy to see this kind of stuff, you know, and that stuff inspires me musically. People are like, well, how is reading a comic book inspiring musically? I don't get it. I feel like I can make theme songs for them. I don't know, you know.
You also seem to be someone, to me at least, who has a lot of positivity. And I don't mean that in the sense of, like, he's a positive type of guy. But, like, even when you speak, your message has a lot of positivity in that. Is that, were you always like that? I mean, you know, Flint, Michigan couldn't have been the easiest place to grow up. Yeah.
Well, my father was a pastor, and one thing about my father and my mom, but really, really my dad, he used to always just, like, with my brothers and sisters, constantly just try and get us to see the bright side of everything, you know, because the truth is this, even if you've had a rough day or something, there's definitely somebody somewhere in the world that is dealing with something far more worse than you could ever even imagine, you know? So it's like, be grateful in spite of how hard things might be in your life, you know? It's like, here I am, if I'm upset because the restaurant got my order wrong and I paid for it, it's like, yeah, but you still were able to pay for it. Somebody in the world is starving. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. And it's like, be considerate and be grateful for what you have, because it could have been you where you're hungry. And even for some of the people that are starving, some of them still have a smile on their face, you know? So, you know, yeah, it's kind of like that type of thought process that I just try and keep every day.
When you look at the landscape of bass players today, and now you have a chance to maybe be someone's Andrew Goucher. Mm-hmm. Are there people that are playing today where you're like, this is the next Bubby, this is the next, do you see those people? Is that a sort of area that you get exposed to in terms of the bass, or not really?
I mean, yeah, of course. Like, I, you know, put it like this, man, people actually ask me that question a lot, because there's definitely some people that are like, oh, Bubby, man, you're a legend already, and you, and they name like me and a lot of my friends.
Now you got a lot. You got a lot to do still. Don't worry about that.
Oh, definitely. And for me, that's the way I look at it. Like, I look at it like, well, thanks for the kind words, but I just, for me, I see where I want to go. I see that I need to progress. You know, so literally, like within the past year and a half or two, I've just got to the point where I can actually say thank you to people, because for so many years I was always like, it was hard for me to take those type of compliments, because number one, I'm only 31 years old. I've only been playing bass for like 15 years, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's so much more that I want to do. And, you know, like, so I've just got to the point, and even Mike Tobias, he was like, you got to start saying thank you to people, you know, because somebody will compliment me and I'll be like, no. And he was like, him and Goucher sat me down and was like, you just need to say thank you. Just so now I'm at a point where I can say thank you. But in my mind, I'm like, thanks, but I got to get better, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned Alan Holdsworth before. Obviously, yeah. We lost him really recently.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, I don't know about you, but it is, I mean, you know, we're actually recording this. I always say we have to be timeless, but we're recording this on a strange day because Chris Cornell passed today also from Soundgarden.
Yep.
The last time I had that, I can't believe it moment besides this morning, because that was just shocking. So young was mm-hmm. Alan Holdsworth too. Like, I just didn't, I think sometimes when they're legendary, like Holdsworth, I just feel like they're all, like, I could always walk into B.B. King's in New York and Holdsworth would be playing. You know what I mean? Like, you just feel like he'll be there next year. Buddy Guy will be there next year. How did you feel when you found out about Alan?
I cried, man. I was terrible. I forgot what city I was in. I think I was in Indiana, and I woke up that morning and I had a bunch of texts, because everybody that knows of me knows that he's like my hero. Him, Frank and Bali and Pat, you know, they know. And I mean, I sat in the front of the bus, the tour bus, and I just kind of just cried, man, because a lot of people don't know this either. At my very first NAMM show, Alan Holdsworth approached me after I had finished jamming with Matt Garrison. And I knew of Matt Garrison, didn't know what he looked like, and I didn't even realize I was jamming with him at Federa booth. And this tall guy with this Beatles-sounding British accent walks up to me, and he's like, "You're amazing. Where are you from?" And I'm like, "Oh, you know, I'm from Flint, Michigan." "How old are you?" And I'm telling him, he's asking questions. And then he tells me at the end of the conversation, he says, "Well, I'd love to work with you someday. If you ever come to Los Angeles, please reach out to me." And I was like, "Thanks." And he said, "What's your name again?" I said, "I'm Robert, but everybody calls me Bubby." And he said, "I'm Alan Holdsworth." And once again, I was just like, I couldn't believe it. And years later, I saw him at a NAMM show. I stood in line to get an autograph signing. I stood in line, and when I got there, I reminded him of the story, and he looked at me and he said, "I remember you. You've grown up." And it's just crazy, man. Like, that's one person that I wanted so badly to get a chance to work with. Unfortunately, it didn't get a chance. You know, I didn't get a chance to do that, but I'll definitely make sure I do plenty of tributes to that cat forever.
And Frank, I'm here. Frank Gambale played on the album, though.
Yep, I was able to reach out to Frank, and he's a freaking sweetheart too, man. Him and Boca Gambale, they're angel people, man. And Frank, I'm still grateful, and even when I listen to that song, I'm still just shocked, like, that he even sacrificed the time to be a part of the record, man. I'm so honored and thankful.
Yeah, what a player. I mean, for me, it was during those shredding years when I got into all the shredders and metal, and then Gambale did that solo album, and that brought me right back to the sort of Chick Corea stuff that I was listening to before the metal stuff, and it was just like, I blame him for sucking me back into that whole genre.
Frank is something else, man. A dude is just a gift and a talent that him and Al Holdsworth, all them guys, man, they're just crazy, man.
Life. Yeah. Well, Bubby, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the stories and sharing and the whole thing. One Up is the name of your new album. Let people know where they can best connect with you online or check out the album.
Well, they definitely, I'm one person. I always try and reach out to everybody. If you reach out to me, I do my best to get back to you. You can hit me up on Facebook, on Instagram, Twitter, all of that. Just Robert Bubby Lewis. And the album is everywhere, worldwide. You can, if you use iTunes, if you use Google, Amazon, whatever it is. Yeah, literally Spotify, Apple Music. It doesn't matter if you're in Madagascar. You can just Google and the record will be somewhere. It's everywhere worldwide.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Bubby.
Thank you so much, man.